And good evening and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and we invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press. And he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in the wonderful land of bird-infested East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back.
Infested is a good thing, right?
I like infestations because, yeah. I'd rather have birds around than no birds around.
Yeah, poor Dr. Burden, though, with what's bugging you. Infestations, unless they're monarch butterflies, are typically not wanted, are they?
Well, it depends on the insect. You know, spiders eat certain things, and dirt daubers eat spiders. So, you know, right. It's all a cycle, and everything plays into everything's dinner for something else eventually.
And birds eat a lot of insects.
Oh, woo. Yes, they do.
Yum.
Once again, you can call in tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And any photos you would like to for Cliff to identify must be sent during the show to wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. We will get to those next month, but please do that during the show, or anytime actually between now and the next show. And Cliff, at the end of last month, you had a conservation tip. Can
right.
you give us a little information about that?
Well, we talked about co-locating infrastructure, including various utilities, and it might have been something not for everybody, but there might be some listeners out there that do have control over where we put our infrastructure. In other words, if you're working for a pipeline company, instead of making a swath through the woods or through a beautiful pristine grassland, consider co-locating, putting along a road maybe, or an existing right of way already. And same thing with other infrastructure, is to try to put stuff together instead of separating it, where all it ends up doing is fragmenting an already fragmented landscape. And fragmentation leads to all kinds of problems. That's where you take big chunks of habitat and whittle it down, and it doesn't work for most birds, for most critters in general. So if you own big acreage and you know that some company is going to be putting a public utility through your property and they're going to compensate you for it, see if you have a say over where that goes. Maybe go through some non-native habitat, or again, co-locating that with something else that's already cutting through your property. The whole idea is just to keep habitat fragmentation at a minimum, and co-location is one of the ways to do that. And city folks can do that as well. Instead of putting a new cell tower, carving out a new woodlot, look for some place that's already open, maybe that's already degraded, and not in the pristine habitat. So just that's what the conservation tip is just kind of think ahead and plan ahead with these things that we put in on the ground.
It's kind of like cutting up their house and putting rooms far apart on the landscape and expecting them to have a coherent habitat.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about our avian world or is welcome. And we have a tradition here. We profile a new species each month, and you gave us a beautiful bird this time. James Childress's photograph. I won his camera, by the way. So.
Well, in this episode, we're profiling a large and vocal flycatcher called the Great Kiskadee, and let's begin by listening to two of their vocalizations here. You can hear it. You can hear it say its name, Kiskadee, or Kicker. And let's hear the second. They're very vocal birds. So the name Kiskadee is a mnemonic, meaning it's named for what its call sounds like the bird is trying to say. So once known as the Derby flycatcher, this bird has one of the most extensive ranges throughout the lowlands of Central and South America, from Mexico south through Argentina. In the U.S., it was once found almost exclusively in the lower Rio Grande Valley of South Texas, but the species has undergone a range extension northward and eastward along the coastal prairies of Texas and into Louisiana. One day it might even extend north of the coast into the piney woods of our prime radio listening area here. This bird is robin size, except it's a lot stockier with a large head and large bill. The Kiskadee is quite colorful and conspicuous, with a black and white striped head, bright yellow breast and belly, brown back, and wings and tail that are tinged in a bright, noticeable rusty color. This flycatcher is not only insectivorous, it's also quite omnivorous. That includes plucking fruit off the vine or snatching minnows, tadpoles, and other aquatic prey near the surface of open fresh water. This species prefers woodlands near water, especially riparian woodlands and residential areas. Kiskadees make a large round nest with a side entrance that's made up mostly of twigs, grasses, and Spanish moss, and once completed is about the size and shape of an NFL football. Since this noisy bird patrols its territory so well against would-be predators like raptors and snakes, there are species of songbirds that are thought to build their own nest near that of the Kiskadee's nest because of the extra set of eyes and extra protection afforded by the raucous Kiskadee. Such protection, however, may come at a high cost because Kiskadees sometimes have been observed robbing the tasty nestlings from other birds' nests. So to see a photo of a great Kiskadee, as Bill mentioned, that was snapped by James Childress of Lufkin, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got some more to discuss about a science article, but we have our first caller online, so we're going to go ahead and take that right now. And this is Mark from Shreveport. Mark, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff, three things, okay? I noticed that the Mississippi kites have left us. I don't see those around anymore. I guess it means that fall was on the way.
Yep.
The birds migrate to survive. And then two other things I wanted to ask you. There are two species of grackles in North America, right?
Nope. There are three. In the U.S., there are three.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the ones we see here are the regular grackle, and now the boat-tail grackles are here quite a bit.
No. The one you're probably calling the regular grackle is the common grackle.
Okay, the common grackle.
And then the one you're thinking is boat-tail, that's a coastal species, and this one we have inland is the great-tailed grackle.
Okay. Well, the great-tailed grackle, I noticed that they hang around like a lot of Walmart.
Yep.
You know, And I wanted to ask you, the brown ones that I see around, that I don't see that many anymore. I guess those are the juveniles, right? They're brown.
Well, the females are a flat brown color. The males are bigger and glossy black. And when the light hits it, it's quite iridescent. So the ones that are not iridescent, they're a little smaller. There are immatures that you'll see in the summer. And they're pretty scruffy looking. They're begging a lot. But the ones that are, you know, really looking like they're looking for food and quiet, those are the females.
Yeah, they're pretty loud, too, the males are.
Oh, the males are super loud. They're very elaborate. They're pretty cool to watch when they're displaying. Yeah, especially April, May, when the breeding season is really picking up. It is pretty neat to see them chase females. Not really chase them, but come up to them all puffed up and calling and trying to look sexy.
Okay. And one more thing I wanted to ask you. I saw a report that came out the other day saying that we've lost close to 13 million birds over the past few years.
That leads us into our next discussion.
we were going to talk about that because that has gone viral. That's good. Those of us in the bird conservation field have been already talking about this. But when it gets into the, you know, when the Washington Post starts to talk about this article that's in the journal Science, then it gets picked up by a lot of folks. So it's not really anything new. It's just accelerating. I kind of liken it to what we've been hearing a lot about the Brazilian rainforest burning down. That's not new.
No.
And it's accelerating. Don't get me wrong. It's getting worse. But with more people on the landscape, you're going to have more issues like that, more fires, in other words. So, to your first question, the Mississippi kites are trickling to an end. Their peak migration was about 3-4 weeks ago, and they're pretty much finishing. And speaking of South America, our Mississippi kites go all the way to South America. It's pretty impressive.
Amazing. I saw so many Mississippi kites along the river this year.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, they really like our river corridor. So the Red River corridor is fantastic, all the way from where it starts up near, you know, in the South Plains of Texas near Lubbock, and flows all the way down and becomes actually the Red River. When you're getting to Wichita Falls, of course, it's already a pretty mighty source of water. And then when it goes down towards Lake Texoma and beyond, it gets bigger and bigger. But yes, Mississippi kites really love the Red River Valley. They love the Great Plains to the north of that. This is kind of a newish phenomenon in the last several decades. They have expanded into the Great Plains. They were pretty much restricted to the southeast U.S. historically, but they've found and liked what was happening in the Great Plains, namely people building houses and planting shade trees. And those shade trees, after several decades, got big and started attracting insects and offered nesting places and lots of open air to hunt for their favorite things, which are dragonflies, cicadas, grasshoppers, moths, just about any insect that flies that's large. And there's a lot of that going on, even though we don't see it, because it can be 50, 80, 100 feet up in the air. There's a lot of insects moving around, and that's what these kites are after.
Well, they're fun to watch. Well, look, I enjoy your show. It's great. You know, and I'm glad you clarify that about the grackles, the three different species.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, great.
And you wonder sometimes, where do these grackles breed? I mean, my God, there's thousands of them.
Yeah, they breed colonially, and there's safety in numbers when you do that. And they're nesting in big box store parking lots where you've got these isolated trees surrounded by parking spots and lights. And so those lights end up protecting them because they're lighted 24 hours, well, not all day when the sun's out, but all night long. They're usually lit up for protection, for safety for humans, but it also provides those grackles with protection because they can see, here comes a hungry cat, here comes a hungry owl, and usually those predators stay away from those places like that where they can't sneak in.
It's sad to think about the passenger pigeon.
Yeah,
how it didn't survive, because they were so big in numbers.
Well, did you get that from the report, the 3 billion bird report?
No, I remember talking to a gentleman years ago when he was a kid. He told me about the passenger pigeons. He used to see them when he was a little bitty old kid. You know, he remembered the flocks that would fly over.
Right.
And it was kind of neat to hear somebody actually talk about seeing those flocks of passenger pigeons.
Well, go ahead.
Kill on a parakeet and the passenger pigeon. That's two sad stories that people need to read about.
And this report that came out in the journal Science that you brought up that we do want to talk about, they do mention passenger pigeon as a bird that was extremely abundant and now is zero on the landscape. There are zero, not even in captivity. So it's completely gone. The estimate was 3 to 5 billion individuals in the U.S. And Canada, and now there are zero. So what that means is we can't take for granted commonly seen species, because in this 3 billion bird report, it also talks about species that are common that are declining rapidly. Like one they named out was dark-eyed junco, a lot of people call snowbird. It's a little gray bird with a lot of white in the tail when he flies off, and a pale bill. They'll sometimes come to your feeder in the winter, but you'll see them fly up from hedgerows and fence lines a lot, and they're pretty widely dispersed. But they're in the top four of most abundant birds in the U.S., top four, but they're showing an incredible decline, and they're not going to be top four much longer if things keep persisting, according to this new report. And
Well, look, I enjoyed this. I'm gonna let you get some other people to call in, but I could talk to you all day about
It's good stuff. Great.
Well, have a good day, and I'll listen to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are open right now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. Referring to that article, it did say that waterfowl and raptor populations have done some recovery, but, overall, since the 1970s, the bird population in general has declined.
Oh, yeah.
Where are the most devastating impacts among what species would you call that?
You mentioned the two rosy, glowing, happy groups of birds. So out of this report, it's not all doom and gloom. It did say that waterfowl and wetland habitat in general are doing well. We can thank wetland conservation for that.
Mm-hmm.
We can thank the duck hunting community for that. They're paying for these wetlands to maintain what they love, and that's ducks in big numbers, and it's working. The North American Wetland Act, the Wetland Protection Act is from, 1972? That protects wetlands as well. We can't just drain them anymore. We were doing that left and right. What we haven't done, we've done a great job protecting our wetlands, so those low areas that catch water, but we haven't done a good job protecting the opposite end of the spectrum, those dry uplands, which many of which are grasslands. And that gets to my answer of your question, is what's been hurting the most. It's our grassland species of birds. Things like meadowlarks, dozens of species of sparrows, bobwhite. We talk about the decline in bobwhite on this radio show a lot, because people calling in are paying attention in the fact that they, grew up hearing the sweet whistle of a bobwhite, and they start thinking about it and going, it's been decades, plural, since I've heard one.
Mm.
So, again, the report is not new, but what I'm excited about, it's hitting a different crowd that maybe didn't know about this. And it's also, for the first time, putting a figure of 3 billion birds lost that we never saw before. But I encourage people to go online and look it up. In my field, it's gone absolutely viral in the last week, and that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it does talk about 7 things you can do, to simple actions to help birds. And I looked at that, and I thought, you know what? For people that are listening to this radio show, we have covered in our conservation tips that we end every episode with, we've covered 6 of the 7 of these things you can do to help birds. And not only have we covered 6 of the 7, we have covered now 40 plus different conservation tips, things that I would even put higher on the list that you can help. Number one is conserving water. If you've got sprinklers that are coming on when it's rained or shortly after rain, we got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got leaky pipes, we've got a problem. If you've got a hotel with all these bathtubs and several of them are leaking, we've got a problem. We take water for granted, and that's got to change, and it's gonna, because that has been, for my whole career, the number one thing that people have been talking about, and that is water conservation. So I know that we've had these hurricanes. Texas just got drenched with Imelda, and there was 42 inches of rain that fell in some parts of Jefferson County, Texas, near Beaumont. But you know, that water is precious, and what we don't remember are those long drought spells when the lakes are drying up and the aquifers are drying up and people in some rural areas, their wells are drying up. So it comes and goes, but it's going away more than coming. And as we keep increasing as a species, our needs for water are increasing. So anyway, I was pretty excited that on this show we talk about this. And again, the folks that have been listening to the show, it's 6 years old now. If you've been listening to every episode, and if you haven't, you can go back and listen to podcasts. You go to the Red River Radio Bird Calls webpage, and Bill has set up even one called the Quick Access to Bird Calls. If you just do a Google search for Quick Access Bird Calls, boom, here come all the episodes, and you can listen to them. And if you want to hear the conservation tips, just scroll to the last 58 minutes of the 60-minute show, and that's what we end with. And again, we've covered about 40 different. I have the number here. Let's see what we've done. Yeah, we're last month was our 40th conservation tip. So that report says 7 things you can do, and we've given 40. And again, these are voluntary. No one's twisting your arm telling you to do it. But if you can do a few of these, you're doing good things for wildlife, and you're doing better things for the planet.
Natural landscaping is one of the keys.
Huge.
No imported grass, nothing that needs excessive water. You know, if it's
That's
not
right.
going to grow naturally in this environment, then it's a water absorber rather than a replenisher of the soil.
That's right. And I'm looking at the report, not the report, but the 7 simple actions. That one that you just listed was number 3. They're not really in any particular order. But it's number 3, and I look back, and we covered that same topic in November 2014, almost 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, and we talk about a lot. People call in with great questions or comments about native landscapes, or they call about what we can do for hummingbirds. And you know, the quick answer is put up a feeder, but the better answer is, in addition to putting up the feeder, put in a wildscape. And a wildscape is landscaping for wildlife. It's part of your yard that you've converted for wildlife. And the first thing to start off with are your pollinators,
mm-hmm.
Attracting not only hummingbirds, but butterflies and a whole bunch of other insects. And, you know, a lot of those insects are edible to our birds that we love. So you have to have insects if you want to have birds. And actually, the bird people are way ahead of any other group out there on the planet in terrestrial systems, because I think if there were as many entomologists out there that have the 50 years of data, of monitoring data like the bird people, they would be showing us some pretty impressive ups and downs for a lot of the insects, because mm-hmm. that's probably a big part of why a lot of our birds are going up and down, mostly down, and it's because of declines in insects.
Food sources.
Food source. It's huge, and it's because of pesticides we're using. We think that Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, fixed everything. It changed things for things like DDT at the time,
mm-hmm.
and that's mentioned in this report that's a conservation success story, is getting DDT off the shelf. We've seen bald eagles go from a few hundred pairs mm-hmm. in the U.S. to over 30,000 pairs of bald eagles in the U.S. Just for taking that off the market, helped brown pelicans, osprey, peregrine falcons, and several other species. So, yeah, we know what to do. It's just it's really tough to actually employ a lot of these things. But again, these 7 simple actions you can take are online. With this report, and it's good if people can employ some of those on their property.
And if you'd like a link to that article, we actually have a link in the Bird Calls post for this show today.
Oh, good.
So that is that will take you right to the article, so you can read it for yourself. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we're ready to take your calls at 800-552-8502. All lines are open, so you'll get right in. That's 800-552-8502. In the meantime, I was thinking as you were talking about about the water. James Bartram, who was a great horticulturalist and botanist in the Southeast back in the 1700s, looked at the landscape down there and said, you people will never run out of water here because it's just so flush.
Yeah.
And now you have sinkholes, you have water wars in Florida because the population has just grown so enormous that the demand on water, and a lot of it is for recreational water. It is not even survival water. It's things like swimming pools and watering your lawn and fun slides. And that's, and it's all fun until you realize that you're draining the aquifer.
Right. That's right. And there's going to be some parts of the country where eventually a swimming pool and watering your lawn will be illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm surprised in some parts of the desert Southwest it already isn't that way. But it's coming.
Yeah. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we did have some birds submitted online, so we're going to go to those next. We have a beautiful set of photographs from Richard Letourneau. And I have never seen, but this is a gorgeous bird, so much color on it. You can see these on our website, too, right now at RedRiverRadio.org. By the way, we're also on YouTube, so if you're watching, Cliff is going to hold that up to the camera right now and show you. Look at the feathers on that crown. That is just absolutely astounding.
And what's interesting about Richard's picture, that his I've got the letter that goes with it. His daughter, Amy, actually took the pictures. I know Richard. He's a longtime naturalist and outdoor enthusiast, and he sent these pictures in. And this is the more amazing picture. So they sent three. This is kind of a collage. I don't know if that's coming through. But this is apparently what Amy saw first, thinking that this little head sticking up out of the water on the Sabine River near the confluence of the Sabine and Merval Creek in Texas. She thought it was a turtle, and I would have too. I would have thought, what is that? Well, it got up out of the water and started to dry off and try to normalize itself. And so they sent this in asking, well, what happened? And I'll tell you, I don't know what happened. So I gathered about five different guys in my office that all work with birds and from various agencies. And we looked at these pictures and we brainstormed. We came up with several different possibilities. The one that I really liked is, this bird, number one, shouldn't be swimming. It's not a water bird. It's a warbler. It's an immature prothonotary warbler. And so what I think happened, maybe what happened, because I wasn't there, but I think it, it could have been clumsy. Young bird fell into the water and had to swim to get out. Maybe fell off of a low-hanging limb over the water. Another idea was that it was potentially something tried to eat it. Maybe a largemouth bass jumped out of the water, or a bufo toad, or one of the frogs, Lithobates frogs, jumped after it. These are big carnivorous frogs. And maybe missed it, but knocked it into the water. And, of course, if you're a survivalist, you're not going to just sink to the bottom and drown. You're going to get out. So this is not typical. You would normally not see a prothonotary warbler, especially a juvenile, swimming across open water like these pictures. So it's pretty cool. And you said these are up online, too?
They are online, yes.
I encourage people to look at this because this was really, really cool. And I really want to thank Richard for sending it and for Amy for being out in the woods kayaking and noticing something and snapping a picture. Because we've all been there where, someone says, I saw this really amazing event, and they go through this 3-minute story and you're like, sounds pretty far-fetched. But these pictures speak volumes, and you know what they say about a picture, and it truly is worth 1,000 words. So I encourage folks to go look at Richard's pictures.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. When I first saw the picture in the water and then you told me it's not a, I thought, well, maybe he thought I had a swimming pool, So he took it, that's his swimming pool. So, but apparently that doesn't work.
Yeah,
so.
And if it's a water bird like a common gallinule or a wood duck, it would not be surprising. It would be normal. But a warbler just doesn't do that. Yeah. So pretty cool.
All right. We have a caller online, Dan from Youngsville, Louisiana. You're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight, Dan?
Hello, Cliff. I don't have a question. I just got a comment of, you know, did the annual hummingbird migration thing. I'd clean out the feeders. I'd fill them up. And in no time, I had a black-throated hummingbird come up. And I've got some in the backyard and one in the front yard. And another one came up. And, of course, they started fighting because they wanted the territory, right?
Yeah.
So, well, one of them decides to live in the front. One of them stayed in the back.
Huh.
Well, next thing you know, a ruby throat shows up, and they both gang up on that guy.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they both gang. I never saw two hummingbirds gang up on one. And what was interesting was that they would tag team them.
Huh.
One of them would stay on the hurricane fence and roost right there, you know, close by and watch that the black throat and the ruby, you know, fuss with each other.
Right.
And then once that original black throat got tired of fighting, he would go roost and the other black throat would go after the ruby.
Cool.
And, I never saw that before.
I'm glad you brought up hummingbird migration. And by the way, Dan, I hope if you're a working man, I hope your supervisor doesn't recognize your voice because he or she would probably think you're playing hooky and staying home and watching hummingbirds because all your observations suggest you are enjoying it and you're really paying attention. So you keep burning up that sick leave so you can watch hummingbirds.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Well, the ones in the backyard, the two feeders in the backyard, I can sit in my easy chair and look out
cool.
big window and look at them.
Yeah.
In the front yard, I have I actually put up a webcam that I had when my dog had puppies.
Oh.
I put the webcam in the front yard just watching the hummingbird feeder. So wherever I'm at, if I'm at work, you know, and I feel like looking at it, then I'll look at it.
Hey, that's really cool.
I didn't say that. I don't do that at work.
That's cool. Well, you're into it. Well, this is peak time right now. The last half of September in our listening area and you know, at this latitude from Central Texas all the way to the Atlantic coast. I mean, there's just a lot of ruby throats moving south right now. So four parts water, one part sugar. Like you mentioned, if you've got hummingbirds that are in big numbers and they're fighting over that one feeder, consider buying a second and third feeder and spreading them out on your property like you've done. Put some in the front, put some in the back, spread them out because those hummingbirds, many of them are bullies, and they're, you know, that there's a reason for that. When they protect a flowering bush or flower bed, that there's just not, you know, nectar doesn't flow like water does out of our tub. So it's a slow, tiny little trickle that it takes a long time to get nectar to ooze out of these plants. So they are protective of a food source, even if it's a feeder that you and I know are, hey, I'm going to fill it up in a couple hours, guy. Take it easy. You know, there's enough for everybody. That hummingbirds don't realize that. But let me tell you about the one that you said has black on the chin. On the throat. Let me remind folks that the black chin hummingbird is very unusual in our listening area. And that if you're going to see a black chin, you need to see the purple on the bottom of the throat first. A ruby-throated hummingbird, at a certain angle to the light and to you, that red will go away and turn black. Mm. And so what we call that is a blacked-out gorget. It's still red, and when he moves, all of a sudden it'll turn kind of an orangey look, and then it'll keep turning. It'll be that ruby red, but then he'll turn it again, and it'll go jet black. So I really caution observers in our area to look for the purple at the bottom of the throat before.
This one is, it has a white top of the throat, then a black band, and then the purple.
If it does have the purple, there's no ruby throat. Not at any angle does that red turn purple.
Those are two black ones, and then the ruby. Yeah, when it goes an angle, you can see the red. You can see the orange. You know.
Yeah, it just changes.
Its feathers look the back feathers look greener.
That's not a good field mark, the back, because you know, young birds can be dull. Females can be duller than males, so they all pretty much have a green back. And then the intensity of the green has a lot to do with where the sun is as well. That's really something to be careful about. But I think if people have a good camera and they have a dark-throated hummingbird that's got purple on the base of that gorget, the throat, take a picture. It's worth taking a picture of, because otherwise I'm going to be skeptical that it's just a ruby throat in bad light.
Yeah, I've never seen these two before. It's like the first year I've seen them.
And that's cool. And I mean, we do get, you know, probably 1 in 1,000 are going to be a black chinned, maybe 1 in 2,000. It's pretty small number, but that does mean it happens. And birds are mobile, and birds can get anywhere they want with their two little wings. So that's pretty cool. Well, thanks for the call, Dan, and keep watching your hummingbirds, and hopefully you can keep your job, and nobody's going to figure you out.
It's all good.
All right.
Hey, I love your show.
Hey, thanks, cool. Man. Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. All lines are open at the moment, so you can get right in. And we're going to go on to some more submitted photos from our listeners, Greg Grant, over at Texas A&M Ag Center. I think it's in Tyler, is it?
Yeah.
Beautiful bird, lots of bright yellow, but just vivid colors all over it. It's just I really like this first one, because you can actually see the striations in the feather and everything. You can see, you know, just the fur, you know, the down underneath it and everything. It all comes out
and
very pretty.
Beautiful bird. And so, remind me, these were in a greenhouse?
Yes. He said they had found these in a greenhouse. Uh-huh. And he had said, well, I'll just read it here. Several of these birds got trapped in a shade-covered greenhouse structure in Tyler, and there was much discussion on what they were. I thought maybe pine warblers. Can you help us identify?
Yeah, and these are yellow-throated vireos, and I guess it's a singular vireo. Maybe it's the same bird at different angles. Although one of the pictures shows, I didn't notice this earlier, but there's another bird to the right of it, but you can only see pretty much his bill. But I can't tell what that is. It's not yellow. You can see the throat, and it is not yellow-throated like this vireo. So this is a good the good message is not only what is it, but how can we get it out? And we talked about hummingbirds migrating right now, and there are a lot of places hummingbirds get stuck, just like this yellow-throated vireo probably is chasing a bug, and all of a sudden tried to get out and realized he flew through a door of a greenhouse. And birds make mistakes. Heck, everybody listening to the show, including me, has made a mistake. You know, we wreck cars, we stub our toes, and we drop our glass on the floor and spill our milk. And anyway, the hummingbirds, though, they really like to fly into garages. So if you have a garage with a lot of red or orange, to them it looks like color, and they're flying by and they're like, ooh, what's that? And the red handle from your garage door opener or the machine, it's that quick release, that's red. The first thing I tell people is paint it black or put electrical tape that's black on it just to get rid of the red. If you've got red tubs, storage units, machinery like weed eaters and power cords that are red, try to hide them just to make it not attractive, because what happens is hummingbirds come in, and then to get away they go up. And so if you've ever had one go into your greenhouse, your garage, a horse stable, that all these hummingbirds go straight up, that because their flea mechanism is to go up and into the sky. Well, they don't see that the garage door is still open, and you can't just backtrack. Well, we have to remember, a lot of these birds, like hummingbirds, have a pea-sized brain, and they can't really figure that out. So in other words, they're just thought to go straight up. That's their thought, and they keep going up, and they just stay up at the ceiling of whatever it is, greenhouse, garage, horse stable, whatever. So if you can reach them with a net, it would be good. Usually what happens, though, they tire out. They run out of juice, and they come down. They usually fall down or perch where you can grab them. If that's the case, if you are still able to grab the hummingbird because it's so weak ahead of time, if you know that hummingbird's stuck and he's still swirling around, make some hummingbird nectar if you don't already have that. Because what you're going to want to do is, if he or she's so exhausted that you've been able to pick it up, you're going to want to have like a little bottle cap. Just take a bottle cap to a water bottle or any kind of juice bottle and fill it with that hummingbird nectar that you've made of 4 parts water, 1 part sugar, and stick the bird's bill in it. And it'll be so tired that it can't fly to the flowers to feed. It's inevitably going to die. But if you stick his or her bill into that sweet nectar that you've made, it'll start drinking it. It'll get just enough to give it the juice to get on out of there. And watch what it does. When you do let it go, it's going to go straight up and out of there. Be prepared for that. And this is the time of the year where we've got tens of thousands of ruby throats passing through. So keep an eye on your garage, and now you know what to do. Don't call anybody, because this is happening so often, and you know, rehabbers are busy enough. You can do this on your own and free that hummingbird, and it'll make you feel really good.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and all lines are open right now. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our feathered friends in the avian world are welcome, and we hope you'll call in right now. We've got one more photo online. This one comes from Trinity County, and it's submitted by Dave Dial. And it's, you know, it's not the best photo. It looks like maybe a cardinal, but it's the way the light is shining on it, it's very orange to him, and that's what he said. He'd never seen an orange or red bird that orange before.
The lighting's harsh, and you can tell because on the fence below the bird, you can see really bright light mixed with shadows, and so that light is harsh, and so it's going to really dilute that red. But I have seen cardinals in molt that get pretty dull and faded, and kind of almost pinkish looking. But this is definitely a lighting issue, because you can tell this is a red, very red cardinal. And you're playing the call right here, or the song of a cardinal. Let's listen real quick.
I got a number of these outside my window.
Yep, so again, that's the sun playing tricks. That came up with the last caller, Dan. We talked about hummingbirds, iridescence, and the angle of the light can really play tricks. Photographers get it. They understand about lighting and where they need to be and what time to be out and where to have the sun on your back and so forth. And I think once you start thinking like a photographer, you'll start realizing that the sun can play tricks like this diluted cardinal or that blacked out ruby throat hummingbird. So just keep that in mind when you think you've seen something odd. Kind of assess the sun and the lighting and see if that's maybe why something is looking odd.
Yeah, midday is not the best day to shoot a photo, because the sun just literally bleaches out the color. And so you think you've got a good color photo because your eyes will adjust, but the camera doesn't do that, and it will wash it out. I know. I've done some photos, and I thought, well, it looked better when I shot it, you know, but that didn't come out that well. All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open. You'll get right in. And we do have one caller online, Ann from Nacogdoches. You are online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hello. My question regards osprey feeding behavior. On more than one occasion, I've been paddling on a water body and seen an osprey flying from tree to tree for extended periods of time, carrying the same uneaten fish.
Mm-hmm.
And so it appears to me that they seem to hunt or want to hunt when they're not hungry. And I just wondered if you had any remarks about that.
Well, how come it's not this, a different bird? I mean, without a bird being marked, it's difficult to know that that bird is Bob and Bob is feeding even though he's already eaten. So can we rule that out? Can we rule out that it
wasn't
replaced?
Well, on a really small body of water, you know, for a prolonged period of time,
yeah.
I have felt that I'm seeing the same bird.
Okay.
Because I wasn't making a great distance with a huge body of water. I was in a small space, could watching it, you know, go from tree to tree, and without seeing very many osprey in general in the area, I thought I was seeing the same bird just toting this fish around.
Right.
On a couple of occasions, I thought, well, maybe this is a behavior that they have this instinct to hunt, yet they're not really quite hungry yet, so they just carry it around.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's also, think about mated pairs, and we can't tell boys from girls on looking at an osprey. They're monomorphic, so there could always, you know, if it's a breeding pair, there could be, you know, husband and wife, so to speak, that you're seeing. But also, if it is a nesting period, they could be catching a lot to feed young, and so they probably wait a little bit sometimes. If a fish is pretty wiggly and you've got young, you don't want to have a fish that's thrashing around, put that in the nest that could kick out one of your nestlings. So I don't know if maybe it's holding the same fish for extended period to feed it to its young, maybe for courtship as well. They might be, you know, I don't even know if osprey do that. A lot of birds do. They give their, you know, the males show that they're good providers, and they offer the female a piece of food. You know, you see that with least terns on the coast. You see it with cardinals in our backyard. You'll see the male offer a female a tasty morsel in exchange for a little lovin', so to speak. But anyway, on your osprey, I don't know. So, Anne, I think the challenge is going to be for you to really watch that bird and see if it's the same fish or if it's the same individual bird or what's going on. But I don't have anything to offer except that I don't think that a bird with a full crop is going to keep catching fish for no reason. It takes a lot of energy. And there's no drive if you're full. I don't go to the back to the buffet table after I've filled my gullet, so to speak. So,
well, you're an American.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, now if it's a dessert buffet, I might do that.
Oh, there you go, the dessert buffet.
Or you're on a cruise in a midnight buffet.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, the osprey, if you watch, they always, when they're flying with their fish, they always have it fashioned where the head of the fish is first.
Yeah.
And so it's very streamlined that way. So head first, tail last, never in reverse. And so they're pretty efficient at making sure everything is aerodynamic when they're flying. And so what I've also seen is they'll fly to a top of a snag or a pole, telephone pole, and they'll eat the good stuff and throw out the rest. I mean, we do the same thing. You don't eat every inch of a fish, so the osprey's no different. And they don't swallow things whole, because if you look at what they're catching, it might be a 2-pound fish, and they're breaking off bits and pieces with their beak, just like you would expect to get those little morsels. But anyway, I think that's a neat bird to watch. There's not many months, or really any months, that we don't have ospreys in our listening area. We get them just about, I'd say, 11 months of the year for sure. There's 1 month maybe in the dead of summer where we don't get a whole lot. We have very few breeding pairs this far south. You know, and that's surprising when any of us go up to Montana, for example, and we'll see lots of nesting ospreys, and you'll see lots of platforms. People want to build platforms, and the ospreys will use it. And that mentality comes down here, and I have to caution people, you know, that might sound like a good Boy Scout project, but we just don't have a lot of ospreys to accommodate. So that Boy Scout project works really good in Montana, but not so good in the South. So Anyway, so you got some homework to do, Ann. Watch your osprey and see if you're getting duped or not. If they're, you know, switching out individuals or just carrying the same fish or what.
Well, here's a tip, too. You can find where it's nesting, and if you just keep it seen, yeah, flying back to the same nest, because that's going to be pretty high up in the trees, isn't it?
Well, they're not always very high, because a lot of times it's dependent on how tall the tree or power pole is that they're used. But an osprey nest is easy to spot because it's made of sticks, and it's about the size of a go-kart. I don't know how, how about a dorm fridge? That I think everybody knows the size of a dormitory refrigerator. That's even small compared to the osprey nest. It might be the size of two dormitory fridges. So they're easy to spot, and they can be, I've seen them low, 20 foot, depending on how tall the fork in the tree is, or they really like those big, large diameter trees that have topped over, and there's just nothing except this flat top, and they start the nest on that. And that might be only 20, 30 feet above the water. But then I've seen them in power poles way up.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's a wetland bird, so it's usually near water, and those nests are easy to spot. Huge. Cool. Okay, Ann. Well, thanks for the call. Great bird.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have about 8 minutes left in our show, and we have Taylor from Minden on next with Cliff. Taylor, what's your question tonight?
Cliff, I'm wondering about, well, with duck hunting at least, you occasionally see hybrids. It seems like it's typically a hybrid between a mallard and another species.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if there are any other groups of birds that you see that ready hybridization in.
Hummingbirds. Hummingbirds and ducks have a lot in common in that they will copulate with just about anything of a like species. And so you see a lot of hybridization, like you mentioned, in waterfowl. You see a lot in hummingbirds as well. We won't really encounter that in Louisiana or East Texas, just because we're predominantly in ruby-throated country, and where they're coming and going, they're in the eastern half of the U.S. There's really nothing else. So to see hybrid hummingbirds, you've got to go to West Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and points farther north, because you've got black chins and broadtails and a whole bunch of species that are mixing together. I want to say that black chin broadtail is one of the more common combinations of hummingbird hybridizations, but there's a really good, I wrote a hummingbird book, but there's another one that Sherry Williamson wrote that's Houghton Mifflin Press, and she's got a plate or two in that book dedicated to hybrid hummingbirds. So if anybody is interested in this topic, look up Sherry Williamson's Hummingbirds of North America, Houghton Mifflin Press, in the Peterson Field Guide series, and you will see all these combinations of hummingbird hybrids and how weird they look, weird colors and where the gorget is on the male. It's going to be really the males where hybridization is detected, because in general, female hummingbirds look very similar and are hard to tell apart. So it's really in the males of the hummingbirds where you can tell that the parental cross were not of the same species.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Good question, Taylor. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Taylor. And we still have time if you can get your call in, but we only got a couple of minutes left. And in the meantime, there is an online question, and this plays into our conservation and the journal Science article, and that is, why should listeners care about any decline in our birds?
Yeah, that is a good question. You know, birds are good indicators of the environment, and we're part of that environment. They're our neighbors. And we've mentioned this many times, they're doing services, ecosystem services for us for free. So owls are eating a lot of pesky rodents, for example. Hummingbirds are pollinators, like a lot of butterflies, bees, flies, and all those pollinators combined are super important for our food. So if you like to eat food, pollinators are important to you, because they say that about every third bite we eat is thanks to a pollinator. So that's another reason we should care about declines in birds and bugs, is that we need food. And so a lot of the fruits and vegetables and almonds and so many different things that you eat are thanks to a pollinator making it happen, and they're doing it for free. And so birds are also important for communities. So if you're an elected official, you should care, because you might be in an area where birds bring in bird watchers, nature tourists, and those people bring in tourism dollars. So we would suggest that you pay attention to birds and promote them in your community, because there are people that are coming to your areas to look at birds. And there's a whole bunch of other aspects of birds that are reasons why we should care.
And that takes us up to our conservation tip. What do you got for us this month?
Yeah, this month we're going to talk about, a doozy, climate change. Mm-hmm. If you've ever gone in search of a rare bird, you know that they're often rare because of a limited range. The great Kiskadee, the species we profiled earlier in this episode, used to be one of those birds. Although not rare per se, if you wanted to see a Kiskadee in the U.S. two decades ago, the most reliable place would have meant traveling to the very southern tip of Texas. As a primarily tropical species, and despite a few strays, the year-round hot South Texas climate was the very northern limit for the Kiskadee. Today, the Kiskadee has spread north to Interstate 10 and all the way up to the Texas coast, to Houston and eastward along the Louisiana coast, in part due to the presence of man-made oases like parks, but also perhaps because temperatures are warmer than they used to be, extending the range of the Kiskadee. Weather data consistently show that summers across the U.S. are hotter and longer in duration than ever before. This will have significant impacts on the distribution of birds around the world. Some distributions of birds might expand, but those species that occur in narrow, restricted habitats could be in big trouble. Regardless of your thoughts on the topic of climate change, improving our nation's automobile efficiency standards, limiting pollution emission levels, minimizing the clearing of natural habitats like forests and prairie, and protecting open space are only going to make our nation a better, cleaner, and healthier place to live now and for our grandchildren. Do it for the birds.
All right. Cliff, I want to thank you again for joining us for another edition of Bird Calls.
Great. Thanks for your help, Bill.
You are welcome. And you have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers for this show were Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from our phone bank that includes Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, and Tim Schnell. The sound files used in tonight's program for the profile is xenocanto.org, and the recording engineer was Andrew Spencer and Paul Marvin, and this month's bird photos on the bird page were snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be up on our website in the next few hours. And you can listen again to this show tonight at redriverradio.org. Our next show of Bird Calls will be on Tuesday, October 8th, during our fun drive, so tune in then. And thanks for listening. This is Red River Radio.